This is the one and only Coach Rush. Welcome. My guest for today is Christina Macias, movement and breath coach. This is part two, episode two. Thank you for tuning in. So, Christina, I have to read this. This is a great, awesome post by yourself. Let's see if you can recognize it. Okay. So here it goes. Facial conversations. When we begin to move with the guiding principles of a non-Newtonian fluid, we will unlock levels of conversation in our muscles and fascia. When our breath is smooth and relaxed, our movement follows. Speeding up the action creates tension, a different conversation. Both are important. They are just two ends of a large spectrum. I mean, that's fucking amazing. I love it. I love that. When I introduced you in the first episode, I made that comparison, like somebody comes along and just brings it all together, all your brainstorming ideas. And I really want to dissect this post by yourself by beginning to explain about the fascia in general, because we have many listeners who probably, it's good when we just lay the foundation here. So Thomas Myers from Anatomy Trains says that the fascia is basically certain sheets of biological fabric inside the body, and the body is made up of 70% water roughly. So this is, the fascia is there to organize the water into cells, groups of cells, and eventually muscles or bags, like he calls it. And you can also think of it as an orange, the white layers between the fruit, the flesh. And let's dive into this non-Newtonian fluid thing. So I was researching it myself and trying to understand. It has to do with viscosity, right? So how thick, yes, essentially fluid is. Tell us what you mean by that, because I think it's great, Christina.
So I take the basic understanding of the principle. And when I started to read about this principle, and there's so much more I still have to learn. Like I didn't necessarily take physics class. Like all of this stuff is really, self-study. And when I read about this principle, it really started to bring up these like mental images of, all these types of movement that I've done in my past, and how it may or may not have resulted in, the desired effect that I wanted, just so many years. And I think about people, like so many years of doing what they thought was right for the body, when the whole time, they were still feeling that pain and that discomfort. And, because healing is not linear, and the fascia is something that I'm still exploring. And I think there's so many different methods that, again, have different conversations. So if you think about, and again, I'm not trying to create a new method. I'm trying to just like unravel and connect and bridge all of these and create a map of all of these explanations, so that we can pull it all together and use it intelligently with our clients. Yes. And when I think about this principle, when we think about the softening, like I enter water and I just slip into the water, versus me diving into the water, that's going to create, the water is going to, create a solid, essentially, and it's going to hurt, I'm going to belly flop, that's not fun, or I dive and slip in, or, and smoothly enter the water, and it's water, it's liquid. And I think when I started to practice Feldenkrais, so are you familiar with, yes, that method of movement? Yes. Or Alexander technique. I'm more familiar with Feldenkrais. I've done a lot of self exploration with that.
Alexander.
And so when I started to do Feldenkrais, at first you kind of are like, okay, why am I moving so slow? And you had to start to have this conversation like, can I move faster? Can I do this? Can I do that? And then you start to realize like, whoa, you are having this subtle conversation so that if I'm moving, example, if I'm moving too quickly in a movement, I'm not seeing how I'm actually moving. Like, what is actually helping me? As I slow down my movement, I become more aware of my patterns, right? My blind spots. That's how I find people's blind spots, by making them move slow. It tells you
everything.
Oh,
yes. I like that. Yes, definitely.
And, you know, and especially working with like the eyes, you know, and I have people, okay, I want you to look forward and just follow the eyes. And then the eyes will jump all the way over to the left. I'm like, no. Look through the whole view, you know, move slowly. And it's this, to me in my mind, I picture this like neural flossing, with like zero tension and just like a melting, a different conversation with gravity is what I've experienced with Feldenkrais. And I guess I should further define the principles of Feldenkrais. It's really slow, subtle, conscious movement to reorganize the nervous system and the muscles. It's like getting the muscles out of the way, because essentially our muscles dictate where our bones are.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I think that a lot of people get stuck in corrective exercise and they're trying to retension strings. They're like, imagine the whole body is always like strings. Okay, I'm gonna tension this one and detension this one. It's like, what if you just detensioned all of them and then retensioned the strings? Mm-hmm. It's like Feldenkrais is that detensioning, the melting into the ground, and that getting that feeling of, okay, what does your left, you know, shoulder blade feel like? What does your right shoulder blade feel like? And getting all of these internal sensations of what's happening. And then as we speed up the movement, which is absolutely necessary and nutritious, we know that in that speeding up of the movement, everything is coordinating together. And that happens over time, right? When I learn like any floor work, I'm learning each individual movement, and then can slowly begin to integrate all the movements together. And then all of a sudden I'm doing them quickly and I'm not thinking. I've ingrained all these patterns into my body.
That's so interesting. So fascinating. I mean, it's like, With the movement itself, you're emulating the stuff you're made out of. I mean, the non-Newtonian fluid. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that. I wish I had a more detailed answer for you. I feel like this is still a concept that I'm truly exploring. It's like I created that post. And I'm like, oh, what is that? What does that fully mean, and how do I express that? And I think just to even dive into the root of non-Newtonian, I think is so interesting. I don't know if you saw my post on naming structures and naming theories. It's like, it doesn't apply to the principles of physics that we understand. So it's just non-Newtonian. So it's like, it must be magic, because it's like, doesn't follow these principles. So how many sets of principles are there really? Mm-hmm. Which is so interesting to me. I guess, you know, I don't know. I'm going to say that in this moment. I think we're playing around with the water essence of ourselves. And like, again, as a non-Newtonian fluid, because we are made up of water, definitely softening our movement maybe allows for more blood flow, which is, again, you know, mostly water as well. Are we increasing blood flow? How are we moving the blood around? I think that there's a, you know, in the idea of moving fast, and also not even moving fast, but providing tension. I don't know. There's so many different ways of conversing.
You see,
I'm not fully.
Yeah, I think that it's more like a natural way of moving. Because sports, fitness, all these kinds of activities are usually there for hypertrophy, muscle gain and flexibility gain and whatnot. But when I saw your video and the movements you did, it's more like complete expression of that element, H2O, and everything that's inside. So that's the reason why it's so, it's primer coding. it's like
exactly. Yeah. It's so.
That's why it's so nail on the head. The whole thing makes just sense to me. That's why it's beautiful. Yeah.
And for me, I laugh because it's everybody's logical mind wants me to explain, you know, what does that mean? It's like move and find out, because the language of the body and of the breath is not one of words. It's one of movement and feeling.
Exactly.
So I can explain this concept till you're blue in the face, but until you experience it and experience that like actual softening, and then all of a sudden you're like, why do I want to cry? Why do I want to laugh? Why do I feel angry? Why do I feel, and like all of, as you soften, all of these parts of you soften that, you know, or holding all of this emotion and this trauma and this tension, or holding even happy peak experiences, you know, we can release those too. So we can, again, we're releasing all of the, you know, these experiences from the body so we can, you know, take in more, you know, and just, yeah, that conversation with yourself.
That's,
and yep. This is what I'm really, I think, with primal coding, starting to develop more, this idea of the story. This is a kind of a newer way of explaining and a way of expression of primal coding. So I'm using my class, actually, my weekly class, to further dive into what this means to me and how do I unlock people's story in their body.
Yeah, I mean, the word conversation is so fitting in that context. And I think we have this nervous system, like you said earlier in episode one, we have this nervous system, but it's not just, you know, the brain. It goes through the whole
body. Can you repeat what you said? I apologize. There was a call that I thought I put this in silent. There was a call that came in. My apologies. Repeat.
Okay. Yeah. No problem. You know, we have this nervous system, and it's not just our brain. It goes through the whole body. So there's like ancient techniques or ways or philosophies that say other parts of the body can become intelligent as well. And I've recently talked about the second brain on Instagram. I made some stories about that mm-hmm. it's the area below the belly button where, you know, we have so many nerves there, so many nerve cells. And mm-hmm. researchers tell us that they refer to that as a second brain. And this is also something I wanted to ask you. I am practicing this on a regular basis with my clients in my courses. And what are the effects of regularly practiced belly breathing from your experience?
So I think it's the first brain.
Okay, cool. I like it.
I think it's the first thing. Your body is the first thing to react to a situation. You get a trauma, your body is the first thing to react. And then your conscious mind is just trying to keep up and process it all. If you're familiar with the polyvagal theory, which is Stephen Porges' wonderful theory that is similar to primal coding in that it really sits its principles of understanding the vagus nerve and how in a more detailed way. And it really, in the beginning of the book, I remember in like one of the forewords, it's saying, you know, all of these psychological therapies would exist without the polyvagal theory. But what this theory does is unify them and explain them in a way that involves like the neuroscience and really explaining, okay, wow, the vagus nerve is is a powerhouse. It's a powerful thing. And if we don't have, it's either you're observing it and you're learning to, I don't like, cause I try not to say the word control, cause it's not about control. It's about managing, or it's managing you. Something's going to happen. This is what I tell people. It's like, either you're doing it or it's going to happen. So you might as well do it consciously. And, you know, this is where we get into the realm of somatic therapy. And now we're getting into the somatic experience and then the part of the body that holds trauma. And, you know, it's like, why, you walk into a certain room and you hear a certain song, your body's freaking out, but your conscious mind's like, I'm safe. But when you last heard that song, something traumatic happened and you're not even realizing that that song's a trigger. It's that second brain or first brain reacting to that. Mm. That makes sense.
Yeah. It is the primal coding again.
Thank you. Yeah. Cool. And so belly breathing, I guess to answer your question, belly breathing, it's a powerful breath. It's one of the many powerful breaths. It's again, there's so many different patterns. I think that's the first breath that people kind of learn. It's like this like entry pattern, but it doesn't mean that it holds less power. It's like the most simple things have really truly have the most power.
Yes.
So it's a great little introduction to, you know, breathing in a parasympathetic way. That for the, you know, go-to, right?
I mean, there are lots of personal trainers and coaches amongst my listeners. And one thing that is of high interest, I think, is how can we get someone to open up their breathing, I just call it now breathing channels, breathing channels better. So, for example, I had a client with surgery a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and his, you know, the wall that separates the left and the right nose holes. I don't know the term in English. Yeah. This wall basically is not straight anymore. And he has trouble breathing in through the nose, and it's affecting his whole exercising. And, most of all, the rhythm, you know, when he's doing an exercise, the phase, like the concentric and the eccentric phase, he's always having trouble with the rhythm of the breathing there. Mm-hmm. So do you have any advice, any piece of advice for that?
So it's an interesting question because you're dealing with a structure, you know, and if it was deviated because of the surgery, or if that has always been a case, like this is an acute deviated, we call it a deviated septum. So they have like less, so they're breathing in less air. They already have this like less volume of air. So they always, if they breathe through their nose, they feel like they're suffocating, you know? But this kind of, I don't know, like a catch 22, because if you're not breathing through your nose, and you're just breathing through your mouth, this can create more of an issue because you're not, you know, you're not using that pathway, and it can change the structure of, you know, your face, your nose. So this is, if this has been a pattern since you were a kid and you've spent, you know, your whole childhood not being able to breathe through your nose, it can be a challenging thing. So, you know, obviously, when I work with people, I don't want them to be so aware of like what they can't do. You know, I think that when I first started to teach, you know, I would say, oh, so you're not breathing to your belly. This is how you do it. And that's great. But you know what? It sometimes that causes people to have anxiety because they're not doing it. And then they freak out. They're like, oh my God, why am I not breathing into my belly? Like, why is it not working? Now I can't do it. What can't? And so if we don't focus on so much what they can't do, focus on what they can. So first, see if they have any capacity of just breathing through their nose. And this is, you know, if they can spend a few minutes a day practicing the nose breath, which for them is a complete CO2 tolerance exercise, right? Because they're used to a larger breathing volume because of this deviated septum. They are probably mouth breathers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, and you being a mouth breather, I mean, that alone is going to, you know, affect your aerobic output or just your, you know, your workouts in general and your aerobic capacity and just the ability for you to even have strength. Like most of my workouts are done in and out of the nose. Unless I'm like deadlifting something heavy, I will probably exhale out my mouth, you know, to produce more force. Like that's applying breath to, you know, strength training. That could be a whole other 30 minutes.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So, you know, with a deviated septum, you know, having them still practice the nose breath, get them used to a higher level of CO2. This will benefit them. This will get them more oxygen to their body. Because if they are just walking around mouth breathing because they feel like, you know, are so afraid of breathing through their nose, you know, this is step into the fear, you know, step into the darkness, you know.
Okay, so he will be tolerating, or he will, how would you put it, like accepting more CO2 in their body. And as a result of that, what will happen?
So have them pick a pattern. So you'll be, say, like try to inhale for 3, pause, exhale for 3. You don't want to have too much, like do a box breath of like holding for 4, exhale 4, hold 4. You know, you don't want to hold for too long because that's going to increase CO2 more. Every time you hold your breath, you increase CO2. Every mm-hmm. time you move your body, you produce CO2. So notice how those are the two polarities of each other. I sit in stillness in a parasympathetic state. I hold my breath. I increase CO2. I move my body. Increase CO2. So if you're combining those two of like breathing through your nose and working out, your client's going to definitely feel out of breath. So keep a pause because they're already, you know, going to be struggling. So if they can hold an inhale for 3 or 4 seconds, pause, exhale 3 or 4, pause, and create some calmness in there, that will create a little bit more of a capacity for them. And then even that will help train the respiratory muscles. Because if we are, again, always breathing out the mouth, that that pressure of the breath is just being like a balloon, just like being released out into the air. We, you know, there's a lot of power in nose breath. And besides that, if you are not, or if you're using a nose breath, you're getting nitric oxide. I've actually recently been meeting with a lot of clients that have spent their whole lives mouth breathing. They have lived a life without nitric oxide. This is what calms us. So if you can push past that discomfort of air hunger, or I like to be more positive and say the desire for air, you push past this resistance, and then all of a sudden, you start to feel heat and tingling through your body because the nitric oxide is finally relaxing and expanding and vasodilating. So increasing the diameter of your blood vessels, allowing more blood and oxygen to flow. This is the concept of the Buteyko method, which is the Russian breath method that works with this smaller breathing pattern or the tidal volume. So, you know, and also for the deviated septum, you know, obviously surgery would be really the way to improve airflow, but that's not necessarily a choice for most people. So again, being able to expand the tolerance of nose breathing, I think would be the biggest benefit for them.
Well, thank you for that spontaneous master thesis on my question. Amazing.
You know, eventually I'll get my doctorate, so I'm going to save this and maybe this will, yeah. Who knows what I'll research, right?
Man, that's some value here. Tremendous, tremendous. So, I mean, Christina, there's, I wanted to talk to you about so much stuff, like all of your clients, like what kinds of people are these, but let me specify my question. Mm-hmm. That is, what do you think when we talk about potential improvement for high level athletes? We know that from traditional training, when I improve hip mobility, for example, or ankle mobility, a high performing athlete can suddenly jump 20 centimeters, you know, further or higher or run faster or whatever. Now, when we optimize the breath for that athlete, What do you think in terms of improvement of performance is still possible, like in a percentage, like 20%, 30%, or?
I don't know about percentages. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know about percentages, but you know, I will go towards Brian McKenzie and his work of power, speed, endurance, because he's been mapping this out very well and having a lot of success with high level athletes, and just acknowledging him and the work that he's doing in all of the, you know, not just him, but just the people around him. And I definitely follow the work that he does. And it's tremendous. It's what I'm seeing in his results is just from the nose breathing, from like those people training in a state of, you know, a higher level of carbon dioxide, in that state of slight, that always expanding that level of air hunger. And then when it comes to performance and like the actual day of reckoning, of competing, they just let their breath go, let it do its thing. And, you know, the comments of just like, hey, I didn't have to adapt to the altitude. I felt just as strong. And it's because the second that you breathe out your mouth, your posture will start to disintegrate slowly, you know, and then you'll see better posture. And then as you have, you know, better posture, I think also, I'll say this, when I've been recently, you know, doing a little bit more running and jogging, I've consider like a nose breath run to be one of oxygenation. It's like, there's times when I want to breathe out my mouth when I'm running. And then there's times when I use my run to oxygenate my body. And I've been reading the book, Born to Walk. Have you heard of that book?
No, not yet.
So it takes anatomy trains and applies these theories to walking. And it's just talking about, it creates a really beautiful image of the fascia and how our body moves. And then the, you know, the anatomy trains or the lines, that are used when you're walking and running. And, when I run now and I run to the capacity of my nose breath, I find that it loosens up my fascia in a way that I have more ability to observe like my gait and how my foot hits the ground and how, oh, am I hunched over? Or like just adding more awareness to my run. It gives me that space. Cause the second that I like open my mouth, I just get sloppy and tired and like, and you kind of, your form will break a little bit or, you know, whatever that may look like for you.
Similar.
So yeah. So, and for me, I am a climber. So I will say that as I start to get more serious about my climbing training, I'm now starting to notice my breath on the wall and starting to use my breath to train and starting to expand my capacity and my endurance with, again, this simple, back to the simple nose breathing. When I do my aerobic, like sets of aerobic climbs, so I'll do like a 4x4 where I take a route and I will climb it 4 times in a row, and then pause and rest and do that 4 times. And yeah, that is absolutely aerobic workout. Mm-hmm. The ability for me to grip something when I'm like, can I actually grip that? Like, really? But in those moments, like where I actually have no grip, I will reach the next and I'll let out a, huh, like a sharp exhale. And it's amazing what that sharp exhale, because my exhale is connected to my abs and my pelvic floor and my ability to produce force. It sends this like electricity from my core to my hands. And I'm all of a sudden holding this hold that I'm like, how, I feel like I can't hold grip anything, yet I'm still here on this wall. So that's the way I've experienced the breath in my lifestyle, sports, in the way that I train myself, I guess. So I can only imagine, again, the effects on elite athletes, which I have not yet been able to, have not yet worked with.
So
hope that answers your question.
Yeah, of course, man. I mean, what kinds of clients do you have? Is it like normal people, businessmen, or?
Yeah, so it's an array of people. I've been really excited to work more with women recently. Most of the clients that are attracted to me are men, just because I was a strength coach and I worked with fire and policemen for so many years that that's just where I was comfortable. So a lot of my clients are long-term clients are training, like came to me to, you know, be for personal training, and then soon realized that it was a little bit more than that. Everybody starts with the breath. Everybody starts with the breathing patterns. Some people are with me because they have anxiety or they have like actual issues with the spine or, you know, low back pain. Then I have people who come to me who just want to get strong. And that's cool too. But you're going to get all and learn all these different types of conversations. I'm going to find where are the blind spots in your movement practices, you know? And so my clients are people who are ready to look at themselves. And so this can be businessmen, you know, women, athletes who have tried everything and still have this pain and don't know where it comes from. I usually get the like people with the white flag, you know, I've went to everybody and nobody can fix me. And I'm like, because you're not doing your part of the work. And it's not that I fix them. I just give them the tools to complete the healing.
I've heard that before somewhere. Yeah.
So my clients are wonderful and they do shift as I learn tools. All of a sudden I'll get a client that allows me to apply those tools I've learned. So again, what I do is constantly transforming and getting more detailed, and it's really awesome.
Amazing. Yeah, so it's a work in progress and you're developing yourself.
Always.
Great, great. Awesome. So, Christina, thank you for that second episode.
Thank you for having me again.
Really, really enjoyed this one. Awesome. Yeah. I was thinking about, you know, making an internship, coming to California and then making some sort of internship there. checking out how you work and stuff like that. So
yeah, well, we can
would you
talk.
Be open for that?
I can teach. I'm willing to teach people. So we can chat about that.
Cool. I mean, we could also talk about Wim Hof in future follow-ups if you want to. So that could
Absolutely.
Be a potential topic.
We
for
have
today.
So much to talk about.
Of course. And you have a lot to give there, a lot of value. So thank you so much again. And thank you for all the listeners. Take care. And thanks again. See ya. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.